The next area was increased timeliness of court processing. So as people with mental health issues are involved in the court system, speed up those processes so they're not delayed and being incarcerated for longer periods of time. And one of those things was to expedite the completion of court-ordered competency evaluations, which is one of the things that brought the task force together, looking at how can those be done more quickly so we can determine whether people are competent to stand trial. One piece of that was expanding the professionals who may conduct those examinations. So at the time the group met, there were only a handful of psychiatrists across the state that were doing competency evaluations, which was problematic. And so the legislation expanded those professionals that can do it. It was psychologists and psychiatrists were the only two groups. We expanded to add certified social workers with their private independent licensure, certified nurse practitioners, and licensed professional counselors with their mental health endorsements, and all of those with practice in mental health settings, as well as training on how to conduct and score competency evaluations. So we've identified an online training resource that we've worked to make specific to South Dakota laws that we're rolling out now with those groups so they can get the training and become qualified to do those evaluations. We also worked with the psychologist. While they were eligible to conduct evals, there really weren't any psychologists across the state doing those. And so we really worked hard with the licensing body to get the word out to those professionals that they're eligible. And we received a lot of interest. So the list now is over 30 individuals. That's without the new three groups. So we expect more to be added soon once some of those folks get trained. So we've definitely expanded that quite a bit in the past several months. The legislation also reallocated funds that we were using at the Human Services Center to do competency evaluations to communities. So the South Dakota Association of County Commissioners now has a contract, and they're able to give funding to counties as they conduct evaluations, so counties can be reimbursed directly for those versus doing them through the state hospital. So we had $125,000 that we reallocated to that. And then the next piece was developing standard protocols to process individuals with mental illness through the court system and really implementing some of the core concepts of mental health courts across the state that we'll be working with the UJS system on. And then ensuring access to services. So obviously connecting people to services is an important piece of this, particularly on release from jail, when individuals are bonding out, making sure that they're connected to treatment resources so they can get the services and support they need. And those are what really keep people from continued involvement with the criminal justice system. And we're also going to look at opportunities that we might have through telehealth to expand services and get those into rural areas where they might not be available today. The fifth area was hold government more accountable. One piece of that was requiring mental health training for several different groups. So judges, state's attorneys, court-appointed defense attorneys, probation officers, county and jail correctional officers, as well as Department of Corrections facility staff, to make sure that they understand signs and symptoms of mental illness, how to diffuse crisis, how to intervene with a person that's experiencing a mental health crisis, and then also what services are available in communities. We found that in some areas there are services available, but sometimes there's a lack of understanding of those services, how to get someone referred, how they would become eligible for services and funding. So we've been working on that as well. The legislation also developed an oversight council to help us track the work and implement the different pieces, look at opportunities for improved policies and practices. We have a variety of folks on that group with expertise in these areas, including Senator Nezeba and Representative Ahlers. That group began meeting in early 2017 after the legislation passed. We formed three subgroups to really dig into each of the areas that I've mentioned, including screening and assessment, the services component, and then the competency evaluation. I'm going to have a link there with more information if you're interested in that. And then finally, I just wanted to provide a slide that kind of talks at a higher level about kind of the model we're using for this. This is a national model. It's being used across the country to address this same issue in many other areas. It's called a sequential intercept model. And so as I've kind of talked about the different pieces, you can kind of see how they fall into the points of intercept that are opportunities for intervention to help folks with mental illness either not become involved with the criminal justice system or move them through it quickly and get them connected connected to the resources they need. And so there's 5 points that you can intercept: pre-arrest diversion, and that's really training law enforcement, having crisis supports available so that as law enforcement come into interaction with folks, they can divert them from the system and really get them to the treatment resources they need. Two is post-arrest diversion, so that's initial hearing, initial detention, and really diverting to treatment instead of incarceration. So that's really screening and identifying those folks who have serious mental illness, and as a result of that mental illness, that untreated mental illness, they're coming into contact with law enforcement because of things they're doing, usually low-level offenses, you know, getting in trouble with the law that way, for being in places they shouldn't be, and so really intervening at that point to get them attached to treatment. For those that aren't filtered out in one and two, looking at jails and court diversion. And so those are things like specialty courts or in areas where you don't have enough population, for example, a mental health court, you can still implement components of that by increasing the collaboration between the court system, the criminal justice system, and the mental health provider system, and really making sure that's strongly attached so people are getting to the treatment they need. And then four is reentry. So people who need to be incarcerated, who have been incarcerated, as they reenter back into the community, making sure there's strong connections and communications between that correctional setting and the community-based providers so that they're linked to the treatment they need and they don't fall through the cracks. Because we know if that happens, they oftentimes end up back in with the criminal justice system. And then finally, probation and parole. And so that's really looking at when people are on probation and parole, it's important that there is a community support service connected to that so that if those individuals aren't going to require treatment or aren't doing the things they need to, we aren't just revoking that probation and parole and sending them into correctional settings. We're working with the person to figure out why aren't they going to treatment, how do we get them back linked into that, and really making sure that's happening instead of just kind of that initial reaction of, they didn't attend their appointment, we're going to revoke and send them back into the criminal justice system. So that is a very quick summary, Mr. Chair. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. And you can actually talk faster than I can listen sometimes. But you did a very good job, and I appreciate you. There's a lot going on. Very interesting stuff. I'd open it up for committee questions. I guess the big question is, what can the legislature do to help? What are your areas of concern, and what can we do?
Well, you know, I think right now we're in a good place with our group and kind of where we're trying to go with services. So I don't see anything needed, you know, at the moment. You know, I think as we dig into this and determine, do we have the services and supports people need? You know, are there gaps in the system? Maybe something we come back at some point with a need. But I think for right now we're in a good place. We have some, as I said, legislators on our group, which is helpful. So they're aware of the issues and we'll be aware of the discussion as we move forward.
I did have one question that maybe I wasn't. Okay. One question that you kind of said in your presentation there. When someone's arrested, they go in and anybody, not a psychologist or anything, can give them a list of 10 questions to determine if they're mentally ill or what's going on. How can that happen in 10 questions? What kind of questions could they possibly ask to tell you?
Yeah, so it's a national tool that's used across the country in correctional settings. We actually use it in the prison system as well. And so there are some basic questions about a person's functioning, whether you've been depressed, what's your mood been like, are you hearing things that maybe other people don't hear? So it's really high-level questions. It's not meant to determine, do they have a mental illness? It's really meant to determine, it's a screen. So are there some indicators that maybe there's something going on here? So it's a pretty high-level screen. Correctional officers can do the screen because the questions are fairly straightforward and simple, and then they rate them within the tool. And then if you have a certain number that a person is indicating yes to, then that requires you need to talk with a mental health professional to really dig in. It may be that there's not a mental illness there, but there's some indicators, and so we would want then a further assessment by a professional.
And how about, do they learn to sort of play that system so they don't end up going to jail? They go someplace else that's a little bit nicer than jail? I mean, it doesn't seem like it would take long for that to get around. This is what you say if you want to
if I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and that's, you know, people with true mental illness are going to respond in a way that they're not going to be gaming it. Certainly, you have people in the correctional system that may, and that's why it's a screen, and you would go on to a mental health professional to indicate, is there really a mental illness there, or is it something else? And they are trained to differentiate.
Police are all trained to do that.
Mental health providers are trained. Law enforcement certainly have some awareness of that as well with the populations that they see.
Okay.
So where are we at in the, what percentage complete would you think we are with the law enforcement agencies in South Dakota to do some of those initial diversions and screenings and things?
Well, they've got the pilot started. I'm not sure the exact number of sites. I think it's 5 or 6 sites across the state that they're currently working with. And then from there, the plan is to look at rolling that out to have those screens available in all jails across the state. So they'll be doing the pilot, I would anticipate, for at least the next 6 months to really work out the bugs, figure out, you know, is this tool working? Do we need to look at other possible things that, you know, would be better? So that's designed to kind of give us that time before we roll it out, and the Sheriff's Association, as I said, is really leading that effort.
Excellent. Other questions?
May I again?
Yes.
Okay. Now, your department would be the one in charge of Child Protection Services, too. Is that correct?
Yes, that's within
DSS. Okay. So when you get a complaint about a child maybe living in bad conditions of some kind, what's the step-by-step process? I mean, what if it's really a struggle? I'm going to give you an example. A teacher at the school that I'm at reported to CPS that a child had been coming smelling of cat urine, and he was, you know, dirty and not well taken care of. Nobody was checking on homework. So she did report that. And the answer that she got back, well, was that, well, this child is almost 11 years old. He, too, could help clean up the pet mess at the house, and he, too, could improve his living conditions. That, to me, wasn't satisfactory at all.
If I may, Mr. Chair. And we can certainly visit after, you know, but in general, the process is the referral would go to CPS, and then they would do an intake, and then, if needed, an investigation to determine if there are safety issues, and that's really what they're looking at. Are there safety issues in that home within that situation for that child? And then if there are, a plan is developed to address those, either working with the family if that's possible, bringing in extended family to help, or removal from the home if the situation warrants it. But we can certainly follow up on your specific example.
So it's more just safety rather than quality of life. I mean,
yep. The focus for child protection is around safety of the child, which could include abuse situations or neglect. If there's neglect of the child that leads to safety, that could certainly be part of it.
Okay, well, again, thank you. Very important topic. And again, I appreciate your bringing it for us today and then rushing through it as well. So thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
We also have an opportunity to hear from the Department of Human Services about long-term support and services. So, Secretary Pearson, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Pearson. I'm the Secretary of the Department of Human Services. And I'm very pleased to be with you here today and talk to you a little bit about what's going on with long-term services and supports. As you're well aware, the reorganization occurred, which moved Adult Services and Aging over to the Department of Human Services. And as I explained before, it is for us to further leverage the experience in the other divisions in terms of providing long-term services. Now, why is that important? I guess what I would like to tell you is that there are demographic changes going on in South Dakota, which I'm sure you're aware of. You've all heard of the gray tsunami, I'm assuming. And we're not talking about water in this instance. We're talking about the aging of the population of South Dakota. And what occurs as a result of that is that more people are seeking services. And along with the need for more people to require services, we also have the result of a staffing crisis, which is there are less workers out there now. And the people that are aging are in need of more supports, and that requires workers. So that's kind of a level set to this presentation. So as soon as Adult Services and Aging moved to the Department of Human Services, I invited a broad cross-section of stakeholders, including providers, advocates, legislators, professionals in the field, to come together to serve on a work group to participate in goal setting and strategies in this area to help us move forward and address the challenges that we know are here and are coming. Our legislators on the group are Senator Soho and Representative Hunhoff. The task force has been meeting quarterly to do this work, and I'm going to tell you some more about the goals and strategies and metrics that they have identified as I get further in my PowerPoint. But first of all, what I have up here is the vision for the Division of Long-Term Services and Supports. And you can see that, it truly is, all these services are to maximize the health and well-being and quality of life of South Dakotans who need these services. And we want to do that through a person-centered system that encourages choice and independence and supports people to stay in their own homes and local communities. You may have heard of the app study, which gives us a projected demand for services. And as I mentioned before, you know, we have the gray tsunami occurring. As you can tell by the chart, in 2030, there are going to be 33,000 more people that are probably going to be coming forward needing some sort of services. Now, that's only 12 years away. So 33,000 more people in 12 years. We are already seeing some of the impact of this, and there is an uptick in growth. This gives you an idea of where we're at in South Dakota in terms of the balance of funding. In South Dakota, the nursing home funding is 82% of our spend, as opposed to community-based, which is 18%. Nationally, this is more around 41%. As you can see, we compare that with people with developmental disabilities, and in that arena, only 22% of the funding is spent in institutionals, and 78% of the money is spent in community settings. So what does this mean? Basically, across the country, there's a rebalancing going on in terms of more money being spent in home and community-based services versus the nursing home services. And, we also need to move more towards this trend because it's simply unaffordable to support everyone in a nursing home setting that's going to need services. I've included this chart simply to show you kind of the shortage of home health care, AIDS, and as you can see from this chart, this includes personal care, psychiatric, and home health care, direct care workers per 1,000 population for people 65 or older. At the time this study was done, South Dakota was dead last. What I can tell you was the AARP school scorecard, where this data came from, came out again in 2017, and we are now 37th. Is that an improvement? Yes, it is. But does it, you know, fix our problem? Probably not. This slide I've included simply to show you that there's a disproportionate amount of money spent on people with disabilities and people who are elderly in the Medicaid system. So people with disabilities, adults with disabilities, make up 12% of the population roughly, but receive 36% of this funding. And I want to bring your attention to seniors, which at the time this was done, and this is not South Dakota data, this is generic data. So 9%, if 9% of your population is made up of seniors, they are typically receiving around 21% of the funding. So I'm showing you this because, you know, that's the area we're talking about, the growth occurring. So back to the work group, the stakeholder work group. They've identified some goals. The first goal being that we want long-term services and supports to be available to people in their home communities. So what are some of the strategies that were proposed to address this? One was to educate the public on the available services that are available in the state, and then to also reduce gaps in provider coverage. As we know, we have a very rural state, and there are some areas that simply don't have a lot of services. The only service in their area might be a nursing home. So we have to address those gaps. We also need to revitalize senior centers and have more adult day centers in the state for people to utilize. And another idea was to implement community living models that would provide small residential settings for elderly that need those 24-hour supports. And also to utilize local residents in a person's community to provide those supports, rather than have folks driving from a distance to come into their home. The second goal is family caregivers receive the help they need to support people at home. There were a lot of areas identified where families could use more help. One of those is simply in respite. I mean, families get tired. They need a break. They need more respite services. So there's going to be work trying to figure out how we can expand the respite options. And the other idea that came forward was expanding the use of paid family caregivers. Again, going back to this idea that let's use the resources around the person that exists already. Jumping ahead to goal three, the state will utilize best practices to address needs and develop services. We have a lot of strategies in this area as well. Are there any regulations and administrative rules that we could change or reduce? Utilizing national core indicators for quality to make sure that we have a quality system for in-home supports. Also, to implement the practice from the other waivers that are working well, and to increase availability and awareness of the durable medical equipment recycling program, so families know where they can go to find used pieces of equipment that may be more affordable. The fourth goal is to expand the long-term services and supports workforce. How can we do that? We know there's a crisis. There's not enough workers out there. Well, again, it came back to how do we optimize choice in hiring support employees through the implementation of self-direction? Simply what that means, if I'm self-directing, I'm able to identify employees that will work for me specifically. Maybe they don't work for a company, but they are willing to come over and work for me several hours a day. I think at the last time I was before this committee, I gave the example of an elderly friend I had, he and his wife who needed support, and they were friends with a waitress at the local frying pan, and she was providing those supports to them. So how do we figure out ways to be creative around the idea of workforce? We also created some metrics, and these are kind of inspired by the AARP scorecard, if any of you are aware of that, which tracks the progress of all states and compares them nationally. So the first metric that we have is in response to the fact that we found that there was a lack of awareness of the resources that we actually do have available in South Dakota through our ADRC, which is our Aging and Disabilities Resource Center. One of the things we're going to do, or we are doing, is we're working on rebranding this to be Dakota at Home and making people more aware of the resources and a one-stop shop to call to find out where to go and what services you can get, and also just to have education available, which is sometimes what people are needing, and we are working on increasing that area. Another area is tracking how many people get community services prior to going into the nursing home. And access to proper services are effective in delaying nursing home admission. As we all know, if you can help somebody stay out of the nursing home or an institutional setting for a day, a week, a year, several years, that's going to make a big difference in the cost of services and also into their satisfaction of being able to stay at home with their families. So we are going to be tracking how we're doing in this area. We also think it's very important to make sure everybody has a person-centered plan for services, because if people's choices and needs are reflected in the planning process, they are likely to get the services, the amount of services they want and need, as opposed to being over or underserved. We also are tracking the percentage of low care need recipients. Again, we want to make sure that the people that do enter institutional care settings need that level of care. And if we can divert people that don't need that level of care to a lower level, it's a win-win for everyone. The last big picture item is to track actually how we're doing in the whole area of rebalancing. So this is kind of a big picture item to just look at the overall funding and see if it is indeed rebalancing towards community settings. As you can see, we have a lot of work to do in that area. So in conclusion, I would just like to say many challenges lie ahead. We are seeing the growth. We are seeing the result of our aging demographics. And the workforce issues are going to continue to be a challenge. And we have to look at workforce more broadly, as I've mentioned. We have to consider less costly, less staff-reliant mechanisms for supporting people. Some of the things that we are considering and working with are assistive technology systems and devices, shared living models, self-direction, and respite, not only the directories, but services for families. Also, I would like to say that when the work of the core stakeholder group is completed, these goals and metrics will be handed off to the Advisory Council on Aging to follow their progress and help the department going forward. Thank you. That's my presentation. I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And again, thanks for, I know we asked you to kind of speed up, so that might have caused questions. Any questions or comments? Representative York.
I'm asking the committee's indulgence and yours, because I'm still in learning mode. One of the statements you just made at the very end, you said it was a win-win for everybody keeping people in their home. Not quite everybody, because now we're seeing facilities that are going out of business because of lack of folks in their facility, and pretty soon we're going to need them, and then they're going to be gone. Then we'll have another problem. The other question I have on that same line is, does anybody follow up on the care that these people are getting? When we had the waitress from the frying pan going over there, does anybody follow up and make sure things are happening right?
tonight?
Mr. Chair, there are so many questions there. You might have to remind me of several of them as I try to go through them. The first one was about the effect on the nursing homes. And what I can tell you about that is we have to fund nursing homes adequately to do their job. There's no question. But if I indicated the nursing homes aren't going to be needed in this, that is absolutely not correct. The demand for nursing homes is going to be like this. What we're hoping to do is just bend that down. We're not going to be stopping it. And I think the nursing home issue is a complex issue because the needs for beds are not where the beds are located. And we all know that.
Yeah,
so that's a little more difficult. But is what I'm talking about going to reduce the need for nursing homes? No. There's still going to be a high demand on nursing homes. And hopefully through this effort, we can just reduce that to bring, you know, it down. But it's going to continue to climb. Your second...
Follow-up on people that we just hire... A neighbor or waitress at the frying pan, whatever, to come in. Who follows up?
Okay. What I can tell you about that is if it's private pay, like it is in the situation with my friend, nobody.
Yeah.
That's me. That's other close friends. That's family members. But in the case where Medicaid money is being spent, there is oversight. So there will be a level of case management and so forth that follows up to make sure that the payments are warranted, that the services are delivered, and that the quality is good.
Great. Thank you. Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the workforce shortage. I don't think there is an industry in the state that doesn't have a workforce shortage. Are you currently working with the technical schools to provide training for an upcoming workforce?
Mr. Chair, you know, there is work being done with technical schools, but one of the issues that we have the greatest workforce shortage in this industry is those frontline professionals that don't require advanced training post high school. The providers are all willing and able to provide them, you know, with the training they need to do their jobs. There is not an advanced degree required.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One comment I'd make on one of your metrics, and that's, and I think it's great that you're measuring the number of contacts prior to nursing homes. And in addition to tracking the raw number of contacts, maybe express that as a percentage of population or a population over a certain age or something like that. Because as you said, not just gray, I'm kind of partial to white. We're getting a lot more white here individuals. And the raw numbers are just going to go up because of that. So,
but. Sure. Okay, so that would be the metric community services prior to nursing facility.
Yeah,
okay.
Raw numbers plus a percentage.
Plus
I think it'd be helpful. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Appreciate Thank it. You for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Well, as Representative York said, we're all still learning. I guess the day we stop learning, we're probably dead. But I think the more we learn about these topics, the better legislators we are. So I wanted to take this time this morning. With that, and since we're talking a little bit about metrics, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but earlier this session, I handed out performance metrics that were provided to GOAC. Each of the departments provides, not every year, but they will provide to GOAC some high-level metrics, their goals and objectives that they have, and then how they're performing against those. And I know that in each of those departments, you can do a deep dive and get even more data. Because in the interest of time here, we aren't going to spend a lot of time. I really wanted to do it more from an educational perspective. And from my belief that the standing committees need to become more experts in their particular areas and the departments that they interact with so that we aren't relying solely on GOAC or appropriators to try and have a perspective on everything. And while these departments report to the governor and they're in that administration, as legislators and knowing that these people are interested in doing the best job, if you have feedback for them, please provide it. There might be some suggestions, as I just gave. Here's another way to maybe look at a metric so that it becomes more meaningful. But also, as this committee continues in the year's future, you know, maybe there's some suggestions on other areas that you think as a legislature we ought to focus. So I just briefly open it up for any. Is there any comments about those thoughts and, you know, looking over the metrics?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that's it's really good for us to have the presentations and the information. And everybody who presents are wide open to questions at any time from us and information. And we're, that ability to work together and to share that information is really helpful. And I really appreciate that. And I know I think you guys all do a good job.
Ditto on that. All right, and I'd also like to just turn to the whole topic of whether, as a committee, we have areas of interest that we think would be worthy for the legislature to do a little deeper dive. Is there any ideas for summer studies? And we don't have to make a recommendation. It's not a requirement, but it is something that we should at least contemplate. Representative Diedrich?
Well, I, as you're, as we know, as most of us have discussed at different times related to behavioral health resources or allocation of resources or innovative ways to address the problems we have all over the state, especially in rural areas, and especially if, for us in West River, the lack of resources that we have, they're just stretched. That we could use more, and you know, I've thought about whether or not that would be an appropriate topic for a summer study, or be part of a topic for summer study.
That's pretty broad. Is there a specific, like, how to resources, regional resources? Is that maybe kind of what you're talking about, or?
Well, I've thought about different things, like how do we innovate with some collaborative agreements, intergovernmental agreements, to address some of the situations we have with, like, we don't have an HSC out in that area, and that causes backups. Even more important than that, though, we have such a lack of providers and professionals throughout the state, and especially out in our area. I don't know how we work with education, with the universities, with the tech schools, with licensing, with all the elements that help us develop an appropriate workforce. And those are really broad, I know. I'm just sort of throwing them out to see if we have any conversation or discussion.
I'm not sure if it might blend in with I'm not sure if it would blend in with that study, but I'd like to know more about Medicaid versus Medicare recipients. Who decides who gets Medicaid and who gets Medicare? I know it's just seniors and disabled, but what makes you disabled? And what makes some seniors get Medicaid and some seniors get Medicare? You know, I've wondered about that when just in general conversations before, and I still don't know the answer to that. So I don't know if that would, the study of Medicaid itself and how it's dispersed, I don't know if that would be a topic that could blend in with another one.
You know, regarding that, one thing that I would say that I thought was particularly helpful this year from eBoard was they did position papers, which were informative, where I think topics didn't necessarily rise to a study group. And so Representative York, I think that those definitions are probably fairly well defined. And first of all, working with the department, I think you could probably get those answers, or they could be happy to help you. I'm not, or the e-board might be able to do a position paper as opposed to all the resources of legislators. But, you know, you might want to pursue that just with the department. And if you're not satisfied, then we raise it to the e-board, I'd say. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give the committee a heads up. After the shooting in Florida recently, I've really been giving some thought to what we can do here in South Dakota regarding that. I'm not talking about guns or anything like that. I'm thinking about the young man now who's been indicted on, I think, 17 counts. He obviously is a very troubled individual, and it didn't start recently. It's been something that's been a part of his life for a long time. And I know for a fact for example, that children who grow up in extreme poverty or have to deal with some sort of an abuse, that affects their brain development, it affects their behavior, everything. And I thought perhaps a summer study might be organized that would address children like that, or potentially could be like that here in South Dakota, children who come out of poverty, children who have other issues like that in their lives. And in pursuing that, I've become aware of a proposal coming out of the Senate that would propose a summer study to do something very similar to that. So my heads up is this. I know between, from tomorrow to when we come back for the veto day, we're going to be asked to rank summer study committee possibilities and such, and perhaps the members of this committee would look at that particular proposal and give it some serious consideration. And for one, I would like to see it be chosen, and I'd like to be a part of that group, and maybe others on this committee would too, because so much of what we see starts in childhood, and it doesn't just impact the child as they get into school, it impacts them later in life as adults. And maybe there's something we can do proactively in this state to help with that situation, so that what we see going on in other parts of the country doesn't occur here.
So I think what I was hearing is you already are aware of a summer study request coming that sounds like it kind of crosses between mental health and maybe in the education system helping identify and deal with them. That does sound a little more specific, Representative. With all due respect, Representative Diedrich, yours sounds like pretty broad yet. Mental health is a big concern to myself as well for issues in the state, hence the reason for the discussion today. Sounds like, though, we might be duplicative to some of the efforts that we just heard about today unless we narrow it. So that'd be my thought on that. But Representative McCleary?
Yeah, I think probably a good point coming from Representative Holmes. Maybe we need to put health and human services and education together on a joint type of a little more learning experience to get the teachers involved and educators, not only besides the mental health. Thank you.
There would be nothing to prevent us from plagiarizing a little bit or borrowing some of those ideas and putting our own twist on that suggestion if we wanted to, and making that a recommendation, two of them coming together. I know the e-board would combine them in all likelihood if we wanted to do that. I'm just throwing that possibility out as well. Representative Holmes.
Thank you. If I could just have a follow-up, because I know we got to get going here. I had an opportunity to visit a local elementary school last fall. It's in a pretty good area of town in Sioux Falls, and I was informed by the principals there that they see more and more troubled kids coming through their doors for kindergarten. And they come from difficult situations at home, I know, but it's to the point where some of their staff actually went to Boys Town last summer to get specialized training in dealing with these violent kids. And we're seeing more and more of those children coming into our schools. And that's a real concern for me. And so I think if we could somehow organize and I think the idea of getting health and human services and education together on this is excellent. If we could somehow organize something of a summer study, that would be very beneficial. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Smith.
I would get on that same bandwagon. It's interesting, Representative Holmes, and I had talked about this issue, and just right as soon as we talked about this on national TV, Oprah, has a school in Africa, and they've changed their whole educational model. The question is not what's wrong with this child anymore, it's what's happened to this child. And it was very interesting to look at the background and say that the trauma that you talked about, and if we can address those issues. So I think you're onto something, Representative Holmes, and it's an educational and healthcare thing.
I sense kind of a consensus coming here, so can I make a recommendation? Maybe somebody'd even turn my recommendation into a motion. That we do submit a request for an interim study that it would be kind of crossing the lines between health and human services and education, looking at identification intervention for those that might be more violently prone, and that. Representative Holmes, with the assistance of Representative Smith, write up a submission for the committee.
So moved.
Who did the so moved? Did I hear a motion out there?
Smith.
I would second that, but I must represent Smith.
I like that second coming from you.
I missed the motion, though, so... Representative Holmes moved that we submit a request as previously described, that he writes with the assistance of Representative Smith. It was seconded by Representative Dietrich. Comments on that motion? Seeing none, all those, well, Secretary, we can just do this on that, please. Voice, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. I think we have a summer study. We are really right up against the clock. This is... our last meeting, and we've had great assistance. I want to thank a couple of people, and Claire, the committee, has put together a little note and a gift for you. Same with you, Pam. Thank you for all of your assistance. It makes the committee run much, much smoother. Thanks for putting up with me. This is my last time chairing this committee. It's been a real privilege and an honor working with all of you. I've done my best to try and give everything a fair hearing, so... Thanks for putting up with me. And with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
To adjourn? Second.
Motion by Representative Clark to adjourn, seconded by Representative McCleary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We are adjourned. Thank you all.